Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a Community Perspectives episode with Dr. Rudiger Rupp. I'm your host, Marla.
And I'm David. Today, we'll be discussing the key points from a 2019 update to an exam we all know about, called the Asia or INSCI exam, focusing especially on non-SCI taxonomy. The topic was suggested to us by Asia's International Standards Committee. Our guest today is Professor Doctor of Engineering Rudiger Rudy Rupp, who studied electrical engineering with focus in biomedical engineering at the Technical University in Karlsruhe, Germany. He received his diploma and doctoral degree from the Technical University at Karlsruhe, Germany in 1994 and 2008, respectively. He finalized his habilitation in 2018 in experimental neurology, and the medical faculty at Heidelberg University, Heidelberg, Germany. Since 2021, he has held a professorship for assistive neurotechnology at Heidelberg University. Since 1996, Rudy has been with the Spinal Cord Injury Center of Heidelberg University Hospital, where he founded a research group and holds the position as the head of the section Experimental Neurorehabilitation. He has a variety of research interests in the field of rehabilitation engineering for people living with spinal cord injuries. These include neuroprostheses, man-machine interfaces, gait analysis, robotic devices for locomotion therapy, and software projects for standardized documentation of rehabilitation outcomes, some of which we'll probably discuss today. He is the author of more than 400 journal, book chapter, textbook, and conference publications, has been awarded several times for his work, and is a member of several engineering and spinal cord injury societies such as IEEE, ISCOS, and Asia. He is a member of the Board of Directors of Asia and the German SCI Foundation, and President-elect, congratulations, of the German SCI Society. Since 2017, he has served as chair of Asia's International Standards Committee, which the reason we are here talking today, and responsible for the review and update of the INSCI exam. So, Dr. Rupp, welcome to a Community Perspectives episode.
David, thank you so much for this very nice introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here and talk about the thing that I'm really addicted to, which is the International Standards of Spinal Cord for Neurological Classification of Spinal Cord Injury, also called INSCI. No one actually knows this name really then out there, but it's called the Asia exam. And I think everyone now knows what we are talking about.
Yeah, on the history of the naming, this is great. I'm imagining people call it the Asia exam because Asia, the organization, right?
Right, exactly. So Asia stands for the American Spinal Injury Association. And Asia has done really a great job in 1992, really then to standardize the exam. It is based on an exam that has been originally called the Frankel scale. However, the Frankel scale was something really super subjective. I mean, it was more or less than a functional scale. So it was a mixture, actually. Then it was a neurological scale and a functional scale. And I think Asia did really a wonderful job really then to standardize first the exam, which is absolutely necessary in order to compare results of the exam. And also so in particular then to track for changes then even recovery or even worsening. I mean, this could also happen. And since 1992, it was the first time where the Asia impairment scale, so a grading scale then actually of the severity of the lesion, has been introduced. Since then, several revisions then of the standard has been published and introduced. And the last one we saw some necessity then to do a revision. We are very conservative about this because, I mean, it's a standard, you know. I mean, you should not change a standard too often. But in 2019, we thought, okay, there is a necessity really then to have an update and a revision. We introduced two new concepts in this. Because based on our experience then with large databases, and there are several existing, one really large database in the US, but there is also one in Canada. And we also in Europe have one. We saw some cases which we could not really then explain their recovery pattern. And I mean this is something really then, I mean, we are really keen on, because and not only we as professionals, of course, then, but also people with lived experience. I mean, I want to know Can someone maybe at an early time point tell me, will I walk again? Will I recover some neurological functions? To which extent? And to be more precise, actually, then on that, we introduced then two concepts, or at least the concept then in this 2019 standards, which was we saw that some of the patients do not have only a spinal cord injury, but also maybe an injury then of a peripheral nervous system, which is completely not related then to the spinal cord injury. And the question for us was, can we document actually then this correctly? And how can we implement this into a standard to offer an examiner a way that this can be correctly documented and that not actually then errors occur, which of course have an impact then on the classification of the severity then of the lesion. And the second one was something, actually people with lived experience came to the committee and brought this up. Because they, I mean, people were bothering about the fact that they are called a complete injury, so which is the ASIA grade A or the AIS, the ASIA impairment scale grade A, and say, but look, doctor, I have still functions preserved below my level of lesion. And so how can you explain that? So does this have an impact actually then on my recovery? And this was something then where we said, yes, it's true. Why is there this we call it zone of partial preservation? So the segments below the level of the lesion where there are still functions there. And we thought, okay, maybe this zone, that the length of this zone of part, the extent of this zone of partial preservation might have a prognostic value. And this is exactly actually then what we did with our large database information, where we said, okay, can we analyze that? And is this a parameter that is really relevant? And we found out, yes, it is relevant. We can do a better prediction if we change the applicability then of this zone of partial preservation also in incomplete lesions. So not only in complete ones, but also in incomplete ones. And that was the reason why we introduced the second change then in this new definition of the zone of partial preservation. That was the two major changes then that we introduced into the exam.
So can you talk a little bit about timing in terms of the INSCI exam? When along the course of a person's injury can they expect to undergo this exam? Like, I have my injury, I'm in the ICU, one of the, you know, intensive care doctors does this exam on me. Do I have to now do this again ever? Am I going to be doing this over the course of my whole life? And then what if I want to participate in like a clinical trial, or I want to participate in some research? Does it, you know, does that exam and the results impact my ability to participate in those types of things?
That's an important question about the timing. So when is the first time after injury when the INSCI exam actually then brings up some reliable results, and this is still an ongoing discussion. We are still not really then have a perfect answer then for that. However, I mean, there is consensus out there, and there are also some studies out there where we defined an exam 72 hours then after the initial trauma, and I'm now talking about traumatic injuries, which we, I guess it's the same in the US like it is in Europe. It's not the majority anymore, actually, of the lesions. We see more and more non-traumatic ones, and there we have not really a perfect information and really good information when is the perfect time point to do the exam. I mean, there is some, well, so 72 hours after the injury, we get quite reliable than results. Be careful. I mean, in particular with persons that with very high cervical lesions that are maybe ventilated on a ventilator, medications have a negative influence than on the exam. I mean, we need a full cooperative person that reliably gives us answers about their perceptions, like sensation, and can follow, of course, then also the instructions to move a muscle and to move a joint. But this is normally then the case at 72 hours. We also know that the largest amount of recovery occurs within the first 3 months. So there should be at least follow-up examinations, preferably 2 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe then 3 months, up to 6 months. There is still recovery going on. So between 3 and 6 months, there should also be then basically then maybe then a follow-up exam. And what we know is that after 1 year, we call this then a chronic spinal cord injury. I'm not telling that there is no recovery at all after this 1 year. I have seen patients that show recovery, then in particular of sensation, then even after a year. But I'm now talking about really those large, you know, so those large recovery, that large extent of recovery. And after 1 year, there is really then a limited recovery. But nevertheless, I mean, also at chronic stages, a thorough exam, not this fast one, you know, so this woodpecker approach with the pinprick stuff, so da la la. I mean, this does not give you really a precise information, but really a full INSCI exam still then also in the chronic stage might be useful. And now it comes, now I think that's also an important a part. I know that in rehab, when people come to rehab, an INSCI exam, in particular in people then with preserved functions, motor functions then below the level of the lesion, this can take up to an hour, the exam. So it's quite an extensive time that you need for the exam. But it's worse to do it, because often from the INSCI exam, we sometimes see that there are some complications then in the end. So like a syringomyelia in the cervical region. So it's a cyst actually then that develops over time at the chronic time point. And so there is a slight worsening then of upper extremity function. And with the INSCI, we are often, this gives us the first sign, oh, there is a worsening of neurological function. And I think this is also something we should take into account.
Yeah, that's great. So it sounds like this exam has different uses at different times. I've heard you use the word predict a lot here. So talk about, and the ZPP might help to address some of the identification that people put on that word complete and what that means in terms of changes that are actually happening in their body, especially earlier after the injury. So can you talk about early INSCI for predicting recovery?
Yeah, so I mean, there was already another podcast then from Steve Kirschblum, who is also a member then of the Standards Committee, who did a really extensive work on that and put all the information together from the US databases that is available. So from just to summarize, actually, then the results from this. So what we actually know is that about 25% of the people that have an initial complete called ARSA but to make one thing very clear here is, and to emphasize on that, this means there is no sensory and motor function in the lowest sacral segments. That's the reason why this anorectal exam that no one actually likes, nor the examiner and not the patient actually then. But I mean, it is really important because it tells us actually then in particular about this predictive, well, this prediction of recovery. So if there is no function at the initial exam, there is only 25% then of those people initially classified as complete recover then to incomplete, either sensory incomplete, so sensory functions are returning, or even motor incomplete. And however, I mean, it's a quarter. So 75%, that's the bad news, they stay complete, which means after 1 year, they still actually then have no function in the lowest sacral segments. It does not tell us anything about the recovery below the level of the injury. And we are still actually then in the process then of analyzing that, who are the ones actually then who might recover and who are the ones who do not recover. We have not really precise information about this, about who will recover and who will not recover. And I think that's also an important message then to people with lived experience. You still have the chance of recovery. Yes, it's 25%, but it is 25%. And most importantly, what we also know is if there are motor functions preserved at a very early time point, meaning the first 3 days, the first week after the injury, I would say the first week, the first 3 days, I mean, in a person with a high lesion, the results might be not really the most reliable ones. But there we know that about 80% recovered and substantial motor functions, either in the upper extremities then for grasping or in the lower extremities then for walking. And I think that's the reason why this exam is important. It is not perfect. We know that. I mean, the exam is a neurological exam. It does not, well, it is somehow related to functional recovery. And this is what patients are interested in. I mean, one part of the exam is we test the strength of the little finger, the abductor of the little finger. I mean, for function, no one actually is interested in the abductor of the little finger. This is actually then what people are asking us, why are you testing this? It's not relevant for grant. It's not relevant for anything. The reason why we're testing these muscles is because they are innervated then from a low number of segments of the cord. We want to precisely determine where is the level actually where the damage actually then has happened then to the cord. But this is not functional relevant. So there is an association, and we have really good data then also from the European databases, but it is not a perfect predictor then of really the functional outcome. So this is the good news, so to say, even if people might have a restricted neurological recovery, but still there might be then a functional improvement because people learn trick movements and everything. So even if you get the message then from the examiner, oh, there was not so many recovery then detected then in your INSCI exam, this does not relate actually then to functional recovery. So I think that's also important. And this ASIA impairment scale, I mean, when we have often people then in our outpatient facility, and the first thing that they tell us when they come in is I'm a C5 ASB. And I say, okay, that's great. So what does this tell me actually then, this AISB? It does not tell us really then a lot. I mean, this is something we also emphasize is bring me the worksheet. And then I have way more information. So we are compressing 134 exam values then into a 6 scale grade, which is this ASIA impairment scale. And I mean, you lose a lot of information in this process. And I mean, you know, the reason is because, I mean, clinicians need to have a comprehensive information available, but it is maybe not the best way to communicate then actually then the pattern of the lesion, the severity then of the lesion, in particular then to patients And I think that's also something important. Be careful with over-interpreting or even interpreting this ASIA impairment scale. It is important. It is important for study participation. And that's the reason why we think training of the examiners is extremely important. So that they come up actually then with the true neurological impairment so that people actually then can participate in trials. And this was also one of the reasons why we introduced these changes in the 2019 revision, because we wanted to be INSCI the most inclusive assessment that we had. We don't want to lose people to participate in trials, because simply they cannot be classified accordingly. And that was one of the reasons why we said, okay, we introduced these changes. And the second thing is what also can happen, if there is something coming up like your limb is swollen or there is a cast necessary or something like that, then over the time course of your study participation, and then you're not classifiable anymore by this exam, you might risk to drop out from a clinical trial. And this is also something that, I mean, this is unacceptable. I mean, and that was the reason why we introduced all these changes very conservatively. They are fully back compatible then with all the prior revisions then of the INSCI. But nevertheless, we want to be, so my vision actually in the end is everyone actually then should be classifiable and should not drop out of a clinical trial, out of a study, because of an assessment, because people cannot be assessed accordingly.
I think that's such a great point to make. You know, the reason that there's revisions to the exam is not because the exam is bad or it's not effective or it's not helpful. It's just that, you know, once we utilize the exam, we understand some of the limitations and therefore we try to adjust it to make it more effective and to make it more useful for people. And I think your point about, you know, the functional outcomes versus the actual grading of the exam is very important as well. You know, two people with the same level of injury may have completely different abilities at the end of the day. And I think that's really important for people to know, because, you know, just because you're not maybe able to do something that a peer of yours can do and they have the same level of injury doesn't mean that you're a bad person or you're not trying your hardest in terms of your recovery. It's just the difference of the injury that you have. I think another point that you made that was really, that really resonated with me is a lot of times people will tell me, well, I can feel this, but you're just not testing that type of sensation, or, I can move that, but it's just not something that you tested on the exam. And to me, I always just tell them, I'm like, any motor or any sensation is great. I'm not here to tell you that it's not important or not good. It's just not a part of the examination. And so I think it's really important that people understand the limitations of the exam and that there is other functions or other, neurological things that you may have that just aren't tested by the exam, and that's okay
Mala,
too.
that's a really important point, and I think you summarized that so perfectly. And to, really to add on that, I mean the INSCE exam or the Asia exam. I mean it's an exam that tests two sensory modalities, meaning then or are related then to the function of two spinal tracts, tract systems. The first one is really then light touch, and the second one is pin sharp dull discrimination, so the pinprick exam. And the second one, I mean, it tests 10 key muscles then on the upper extremities and 10 on the lower extremities. I mean, we have so much more muscles in our body. I mean, it's only testing those 10, and those 10 muscles have been chosen according to the innervation then from a few segments of the cord, not because of their functional relevance. The INSCE is not testing proprioception, so meaning that you are able then to sense the position of your limb in space. Does not test it. It can happen that people have in the INSCE exam really, really good exam scores. Even in ASEs, which are the ones where no sensory or motor deficits are detectable. I mean, we have just recently done an analysis on this ASE population, and we were able to show that this still does not mean that you have a fully recovered, a fully normal function. And I think that's also important, and because if people simply read, oh, AISE, ah, this is a person actually that has no neurological impairments at all. No, this is not completely true. And the second thing, which is extremely important, in particular for people with lived experience, are all the autonomic functions, bladder, bowel. I mean, this is really, really huge. And I mean, this is really, really important. We know this from the studies from Kim Anderson. That people rate this as super, super important, and INSCE is ignoring this completely. So we are not assessing a single actually then autonomic actually then function. And I mean there is another standard then in the in Asia than the Izavsky, which is then really focusing on this. But I mean the Izavsky is relatively new in the field, and so it's not that established like the INSCE exam. But it's also really hard and really then from the INSCE exam results then to to extrapolate then to autonomic functions. They might not be correlated with each other. So people still have good results in the INSCE exam, and on the other hand, they have huge problems then with autonomic functions. And so these two standards are somehow complementary in order to get really then the full situation then of the patients. And you are absolutely right. It's a limited exam, so we are not we cannot explain everything then in patients, but nevertheless, it's a starting point. It gives us quite a good idea. It's a communication basis then. I mean, if you hand over a worksheet as a patient then to a physician. I mean, if you hand it over in Heidelberg, Germany, or if you hand it over in Atlanta, or have it handed over in I don't know where, people read it in the same way. They have the same understanding actually what actually then these values mean. And I think I think that's the biggest value of this exam, because we are all in on the same page and can communicate then with each other then about maybe then the neurological status of a patient and quickly identify, okay, is this someone that might profit then from task-oriented therapies? Is this someone actually where we need to be more on compensatory strategies? Then, I mean, clinical decision making. That's really also an important point where this exam also has an impact, of course. And as you mentioned, I mean, it's a very narrow viewpoint on the neurological status then of people with spinal cord injury. And it does not explain everything, nor the good or the bad.
And it is an important exam, and as the most common, arguably one of the most important after spinal cord injury. When it comes to this handing over the exam, I lost that PDF, and Oh my goodness, I can hardly remember the ABCD thing, much less all the motor scores. Do you know if there's been an effort to digitize? I mean, nowadays, can I have a phone app where I show my neurologist? Is that.
So one way actually then to do it and is really then to use the calculator. So there are calculators actually then out there who do a classification then, and these can actually then be nicely used, and you can enter the results and can create a PDF out of it. This is not an app really then, it's a website. There are two calculators out there, but really then for standardized documentation, it's quite a nice tool then to use. I mean, it needs to be. Well, it needs to be handled with caution, because not always then these results of these calculators then are really 100% correct, because simply they cannot implement all the clinical knowledge than a human classifier and a human examiner actually then has. But nevertheless, it's quite a good idea really actually then to do that. I personally, well, so we are thinking also on the basis of Asia. Of having an app for something like this. The problem is the limited window screen. So it's really hard to handle all these. You know, we have these 28 dermatomes, we have these two sensory modalities, we have these 10 motor scores, we need scroll downs. You don't want to write a five or a three or whatever in it. And so it's it needs to be comfortable so that people then actually then use it. And we are working on that. We are aware of it, that there is some need actually then for something like that. But the problem actually is the limited size of those nice mobile phone screens. We have it already available then if you have a laptop computer, you can use one of those calculator your interfaces then in order to document your scores. I mean, one of the problems that we have, and we also thought about this, to have sequential exams actually then stored somewhere so that you can see actually a progress then over time. And to be honest, I don't know how this is in the US, but in Europe it's a nightmare in terms of data protection to do something like that, you know, to store actually then some examination values. That's really sometimes really hard to do. However, and this is I think is also important. At least in our European database, where we document patients as early as possible when we see them after 4 weeks, after 12 weeks, 24 and 48. And this relates, you might remember, this relates then to the time points that I mentioned before. Patients actually can ask for a report, and then they get nice curves actually then about their recovery, which could also be a worsening at some point in time of the condition, in particular the non-traumatic cases. Because it's not always then actually then an improvement of this of the function, but it could also be then a worsening over time. Because I mean, in non-traumatic spinal cord injuries, we know there might be an underlying condition that lead to a worsening of the situation. But there are tools out there. We're working on an app, and the important thing with the app is, I mean, we have a lot of I mean, this INSCI exam needs training then from the examiners, and we have a booklet out there where we provide clear guidance then for examiners how to perform the exam correctly. And it would be, of course, then I would say highly engaging then for those if we can link actually then this booklet to practical examples, which are then in an app. So digital age, I'm sure we will move on with this then in the future. There will be an update, and there is an online training tool then, and there will be an update recently also there. Because training is so important. It is not an exam that is super intuitive. And we need trained examiners really then to get reliable results. And it is important, as you said, David, it is really an important exam in order to track changes. And that's really important.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rupp, for being here. And we will thank you for bringing up the calculators. We will link the calculators that you mentioned, as well as the exam sheet, and then also the pamphlet that the International Standards Committee has created for patients and families in the show's notes. So if anybody is interested in seeing those, just scroll down into the show note and you'll see the links there. And thank you again, Dr. Rupp, for being here and for your expertise.
And thank you, Marla, so much. And what I has to emphasize here is, I mean, if someone finds a typo or has some really nice ideas on this adult brochure, so the standards committee is not someone, well, people sitting in the back room then of, I don't know, smoking cigars and drinking whatever. So we are reachable. I mean, you find my email address out there. So really reach Asia's office or reach me directly. We are really happy to get feedback then from people, how we can improve all of this stuff. My dream, my ultimate dream would be a patient comes in and explains the examiner how to do the exam. That would be great.
You heard it here first, folks. If you can do that, go ahead and make your trip to Germany. Go see Dr. Rupp. I'm sure he'll have a prize for you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The paper discussed in this episode was chosen based on a recommendation from Asia's International Standards Committee. The podcast is made possible by the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh, your producer, hosts David McMillan and Marla Petrello, our editor and now production assistant, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at sciperspectivespodcast@gmail.com.